SMQBs, this is episode 166. We are again brought to you by Assembly Software. I'm a Neos user.
I'm a Neos user.
Yeah, we are too.
We are too. We love it.
Neos users around the circle here. It's a great product. Check it out. Call us if you have questions about it, but check it out for sure. Hey, guys. Rooster, who are you sitting down at a bar with this week?
I am going to go to Boston and go out to a bar with Jaylen Brown. Jaylen Brown is an interesting cat. He back in 2016, when he came out in the draft, the GMs all thought he was too smart to be a professional athlete. And it's because when he came out of high school, he was like a total nerd. He got into UCal Berkeley based on academics, and as a freshman was taking graduate level courses there. That's how smart the guy is. I just think the professional sports doesn't do a good enough job pointing out guys like this. He got a NASA scholarship when he was in college. He participated in MIT programs. He's lectured at Harvard. He's just a really brilliant guy. And I think it would be fascinating to talk to him about anything but sports.
Wow. I did not know that. That's a good one. All right. House, what about you?
I'm going to be going to the bar at the Boot on the corner of Tulane's campus and going out for a drink with fellow student Jackson Lynn, the most valuable player of the AAC conference tournament, on a walk-off home run in the bottom of the ninth for a second home run of the day. Hopefully we get to talk a little bit more about that later, but we're going to have a couple of drinks there at the Boot, throw some back.
Did you call him fellow student? Did I hear you say fellow student?
Yeah,
I heard him. You did say that. I hate to break it to you, my friend.
Am I done?
You're an alum?
You can go.
So you are not a fellow student. You are a little long in the tooth. Right. You've not been a student for.
You're what's called an alumni.
I'm a student of the game. There.
I see.
There. Okay.
Yeah. All right, Milk. Who are you sitting down with?
I'm sitting down with the guy behind me, Iron Mike Tyson. Because I'm quite frankly sort of afraid he's going to die next month at this point.
No way.
I don't know. I'm getting worried. He had a medical emergency this weekend. The details are a little sketchy. He had an ulcer flare up on a flight he was on. They had to have medical personnel come. not really a good thing to happen like 30 days before you're supposed to fight a kid that's like 30 years younger than you. I don't think Tyson's going to win this, and he could get beaten really bad. So. Just want to see where he is with his mind right now, which we already know is never a good place anyways.
Yeah, Tyson's mind.
I guess you'd say he's got a puncher's chance, right?
You go. I think it's July 20th, though. I might be wrong, but somewhere around there.
All right. Pope, what about you?
Well, I don't want to steal your thunder, Bison, but I want to go have a drink with the guy in your background, Charles Leclerc. And
maybe he could teach you how to pronounce his name when you're drinking.
We'll be drinking champagne though instead of regular drink. Just want to know what the feeling was to finally win the Monaco Grand Prix. You know, he was born there, son of a hairdresser, dreamed that's all he ever dreamed about was winning Monaco F1. So it'd be fascinating to see how he was thinking.
There'll be more on that shortly here. I'm sitting down with LPGA superstar Lexi Thompson, who announced her retirement from the tour, from the LPGA tour. She became the youngest player to ever qualify for the U.S. Women's Open at age 12, which, that, by the way, that mark has been broken by Lucy Lee, who was 11. She turned pro at 15 and became the youngest winner in history when she won the 2011 Navistar LPGA Classic at 16. And she won 15 worldwide tournaments over 13 years, more than 240 starts, $14 million in prize money, and won the 2014 Craft Nabisco Championship, one of the LPGA majors. And she is retiring from the game. So I think it'd be fun to sit down with her and toast her and hear some of her stories from being really a golf phenom for all those years. So congrats to Lexi Thompson on quite a career. All right, let's get into it. Lots to cover. Hey, House, talk to us a little bit about Monaco Grand Prix.
Yeah, well, Charles is definitely drunk at this point because I had him to the bar last week. Hope had him to the bar this week. And between the amount of champagne, it really, like, there's been so much written about this. But if you are at all romantic about sports, how you could not love the outcome and the story behind what Charles Leclerc did on Sunday at the Monaco Grand Prix. You know, I read that there's only a few thousand people that inhabit that little province of Monaco. And so, you know, as Pope said, he grew up the son of a hairdresser, working class family. His dad got as far as F3, never made it into F1. And he was a good little go-kart driver. And watching racers drive around the streets in the most fabled race of the whole circuit. But his other brothers, who also wanted to race, they didn't have enough money for all of them to race. So the other brothers sat down to the side and they put all the family's money behind Charles, but even that ran out. And so there was an older driver that was in the circuit that saw his talent and said, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, we cannot have this kid run out of money." This guy, Jules Bianchi. And so he lined him up with some money and got Charles, you know, some more money behind his go-karting career. And about a couple weeks later, after that happened, Jules Bianchi died in an F1 crash. And so this was the story of the tragedy that started following Charles's life. First, you know, one race car driver that was kind of the story behind how he even got into racing. And then later on, another fellow driver, and then later on, his father. And so all these people that who he would have loved to see come fulfill his dream, you heard him, if you watched the race, talk about the emotions that were just filling him in that final lap. One of you guys shared, I think it was Pope, pretty remarkable stat that I think it was the first time in F1 history that the starting 10 on the grid finished exactly in that order, 1 through 10.
Yep.
Which is pretty remarkable. But this was his dream. You know, they were playing his home anthem on the podium. And remarkably, I was, you know, kind of screaming at the TV because I'm a Ferrari fan, like around lap, I don't know. They had done the math on TV when he could pit and still come out in front of, I think at that time, George Russell, who was holding.
Wouldn't that have been a perfect Ferrari move?
And I just kept thinking, well, he can still come out on softs or mediums and win this race. And he stayed out for 78 laps on one set of tires. And nobody could ever catch him. At some point, Piastri was maybe 0.3, 0.4, 0.5 behind him. But nobody ever caught him. And he went wire to wire. It was just incredibly emotional victory. The guys who are around the track as like attendants to the track, wearing the suits in case there's an accident, stuff. The locals there are like crying. They're cheering him on as he's taking his victory lap. It was really incredibly emotional. A high point, I think, of this year's F1 race circuit.
House, it was interesting. He said, I'm sure you probably heard this on the broadcast too, but he said that he was actually starting to tear up with two laps to go. And he got to the point where he couldn't see everything. He said he had to talk himself down. He was like, you could hear him talking to Carlos about it in the podium room after. And he was like, not now, Charles, not now. Because he literally was tearing up so much. And he was like, don't fuck this up, you know? But it was, it's one of those races, I think, like Lando winning in Miami where everybody in the paddock is actually happy for the guy, right? Like there wasn't any sour grapes. There wasn't, you know, teammates weren't questioning strategy that could have put them up there. Max Verstappen wasn't the center of the show. And I mean, everybody was happy for Charles to win this race, which is really cool.
But the stat that Pope posted where the first 10 qualifiers finished the race in that very order begs the question, what does Monaco have to do to make this more competitive race to allow passing, essentially?
So
the cars are too big and fast now for that track.
The emphasis on the big, that's what I read, was that the track really isn't the problem. The cars are like 2 feet longer than what they used to be, you know, a couple decades ago when there was an opportunity to pass in Monaco. The way these cars are built, there is just almost no opportunity for passing. I forget who it was that we saw kind of back in the pack do the one passing, which was pretty impressive. It was not even in a DRS zone. The DRS zone there is worthless.
Yeah, it's
worthless.
I think it was a strip
of condos.
I think it was the guy who used to be the Mercedes number two from Finland. Valery Bottas.
The other interesting story, I think, behind that race, besides the amazing story about Charles, is that it's not like Max is about to lose the championship. But there's suddenly some intrigue now with McLaren running well, with Ferrari running well, with Red Bull not running very well. And you've got this kind of huge elephant in the corner of Adrian Newey already announcing he's not coming back to Red Bull. So everybody's kind of shopping for Newey and this like legendary designer of the cars. Is it now, you know, does McLaren take the lead? Because you saw him talking to Zach Brown and then. Does Ferrari take the lead? The car's running really well. This is exactly what F1 needed. Not just Charles winning this race, but some intrigue in some of these storylines.
Well, I think the Constructors' Championship is pretty close right now. It's certainly not a Red Bull runaway, that's for sure. And in part thanks to Rooster's favorite, Kevin Magnussen, who basically ran Sergio off of the track. But the other thing, you know, to the point about the cars being too big, I have a plan for Monaco. And I've told this to Pope and he laughed at me and you'll all laugh too. But I think they should take it out of the points, the world championship points, and put these guys in smaller cars that they can pass each other because
throwback.
The lure of Monaco wouldn't change. The people want to go there and see good racing and have fun and sit there on their yachts eating caviar and drinking champagne isn't going to change. But it'd be a heck of a lot more fun race to see these guys in cars where they could actually pass each other. Because right now, you know, and this weekend proved it, qualifying is the whole thing.
The most fun about watching that race was watching Martin Brindle before the race interviewing all the celebrities.
Yes, it is so uncomfortable. I mean, it is so uncomfortable watching him down there.
He's like, this is one of the Jonas Brothers. I have to confess, I have no idea which one you are.
Well, he's like stopping people. He's like stopping people, whoever his producers are, that are recognizing. Because clearly, like he stopped Alexandra Daddario, the actress. And he just started talking to her. He's like, how are you? It's good to see you. We will see you in your movie coming out, which is something, you know, like, I mean, he literally was hearing it in his ear as he goes, but he's just stopping. He has no idea who he's talking to.
It's
painful. It's painful. Well, listen, the last thing on that is I thought it was pretty cool to see even Prince Albert back there spraying champagne and getting in on the action. And of course, I noticed that nobody turned around and sprayed the prince back, even though he was there spraying everyone. So Charles in particular, who's one of his constituents, I guess. So fun weekend, even though the race was pretty dry, it was really actually a pretty cool sports moment. Anything else on Monaco?
No, we need to go next year.
Yeah, let's do that.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I'm in. All right, Pope, let's talk a little NBA playoffs. Give us a quick update on where we are. Nothing too interesting right now, but let's just where we are for our listeners.
T- tonight is potentially the second sweep of the conference finals. Dallas hosting Minnesota game four. And Boston took care of business last night against Indiana. But I want to dive into both of those series real quick and get some thoughts on it from you guys. So Dallas, it's unbelievable how they've won all three games where they were down in the fourth quarter, and they went on these incredible runs in the last 4 minutes. In game one, they went on an 8-0 run from four down to win by four. Game two, they were down in the 1.5 minutes left, down five. They got six straight points, including Luka's dagger three after Ant's turnover to win by one. And then they went on a 14-1 run in game three with 5 minutes left. So, I mean, is this, and I'll talk about Boston, Indiana in a minute, but is this Dallas just with the ultimate closers with Luka and Kyrie, or is this inexperience that Minnesota's showing with the inability for Ant and Kat and the others to close the deal? I mean, Minnesota could have easily won all three of those games.
Yeah, I think it's both. Kyrie has been resurrected, and he and Luka are clearly just an incredible duo backcourt. But it has to be said that the T-Wolves are soft and don't have the mental toughness to play consistently well on the big stage.
Need a dog.
Can you imagine that's lack of
maturity and inexperience?
Can you imagine if Luka had bullied Charles Barkley like that when he sunk that three to end game two? Gave him, you know, just like emasculated him, and then went to the sideline and continued to berate him, and then in the post game interviews continued to berate him. In game three, Barkley would have put that guy on his ass, and Gobert was like, my bad. And he's such a wuss. It's just unbelievable. And the whole team has that mentality. They're just soft. Even their coach. I'm sorry. I know the guy has a horrible injury, but get the hell off the second row. Get yourself a rollator or a pair of crutches and coach the damn team, because the other guy is not getting it done. Chris Finch needs to be.
Gobert is French, right?
Yeah. What do you? Yeah. Somebody must have fired a shot somewhere, and he surrendered.
Dome under the table.
He surrendered. But you know, look at Ant. We thought Ant was the next Michael Jordan a week ago, and he's shown himself not to be ready this series. Yeah, that was
Brewster.
Okay, yeah. Okay. Well, but other NBA guys have been saying that.
Cat's 3-point percentages in the playoffs,
it's like
12.5%. Yet he keeps firing. I mean, come on, a coach, or a good coach would say, "Hey, man, let's do something different. Go down and post somebody up."
Ant said he was the self-proclaimed best shooting man ever. Big man.
For you betting experts, is it possible to sell short that Rudy Gobert will not win next year's Defensive Player of the Year? Because you can lock that up.
Yeah. He's been exposed. Well, so continuing real quick, Luka and Kyrie have set a record for the last 50 years. First, starting backcourt, three games, they've each scored 30-plus points during the postseason. Ridiculous. Gafford and Lively. I don't know if you guys saw this stat. Dallas's alley-oop dunks, or the lobs, or whatever you want to call it, they've got more than any all of the other postseason teams combined. It's ridiculous. Like 49 to like 6 or 7. So
is Lively playing tonight?
Lively is out tonight. And I think if the series was closer that he might play. But they're holding him out for precaution, which is a great idea. I mean, you know, one of the things that we're going to see is that if Dallas takes care of business tonight, then, you know, we've got an unprecedented, both teams have an unprecedented rest until June 6th.
The finals start on Christmas Eve, right?
Yeah, exactly. 2025. Yeah. June 6th. We have almost a 2-week gap. Between the end of the conference finals, because you don't expect both conference finals to be 4-0. And it'll be interesting to see who does that help more. I mean, I would think that Boston hopes they get KP back You know, Dallas, obviously Luka is banged up and he could use the rest and get lively the rest as well. So Dallas wants to take care of business tonight. They don't want to have to go back to Minnesota, potentially, you know, lose there and then come back and play a game. You know, you just don't ever want to give hope to a team like Minnesota that right now is so demoralized. 154-0. That's the record of teams winning series when they're up 3-0 in the NBA. It has to happen. It has to happen at some point. The Boston Red Sox proved that. But the other thing going for the Dallas tonight is Kyrie Irving is 14-0 in closeout games in his NBA postseason career, which is ridiculous stat. And so I hope it's not close. I don't want another close game. I'd like to see it taken care of. Indianapolis, on the other hand, they had a 90% chance in games 1, 3, and 4 to win in the fourth quarter, and they lost all of those games. So, again, I ask you, did Boston earn those wins, or did Indianapolis choke?
Indy choked.
I agree.
Indy choked. They were a turnover machine. I mean, look.
I thought that was rhetorical. Sorry.
No.
It's a legit
Jaylen question. Brown, Derek White have been making ridiculous shots. Al Horford, like, turned back the clock that one game and made three after three after three. But Indiana had no excuse for some of those turnovers, just complete unforced errors. And I think it's crazy. Both, like you said, Pope, both these teams that are down should be at least series. I mean, the Celtics series should either be 2-2 or the Pacers up 3-1 rather than them being home. And I think that series should be 2-1 T-Wolves.
It could easily be.
Yeah.
I mean, they played well enough in the 3.5 quarters to win all three of those games. And, you know, we all watched and just could not believe how Indianapolis threw away game one. I mean, at Boston, that game was over. Ridiculous. So
can we go back to one thing you said, though, Pope? I just want to follow up on this, that the finals start on June 6th.
Yes.
So it's like 9 days off for these teams.
Yes.
No matter what.
Preposterous. Yeah.
No matter what. It's because
that's stupid. That's just stupid.
ABC locks them in on it. It's all part of the advertising package. It's June 6th. The game, the dates are already all set. You know, I mean, everybody knows going in it's June 6th. That's how they
promote. Can you name one show that's on ABC primetime at night? Can anybody on this podcast?
Desperate Housewives.
Blue Blood.
I don't think it's still on.
Falcon Crest?
The Bachelorette?
Yeah, right?
Dynasty.
You're telling me they cannot.
Milk, I think you're right, Milk. I think The Bachelor and Bachelorette are still on.
You're telling me they cannot just put these games on TV and get moving? Can you imagine the crazy lead up we're going to have? The commercial, it's going to be like a political campaign. The commercials are going to be every 5 seconds. You know, how many times are we going to see one of these players on Good Morning America? It's preposterous.
You know, I think considering that Micah Norry is actually head coaching the T-Wolves right now and not Chris Finch, we have four teams left with mediocre coaches. And I think Jason Kidd is rising to the top of that mediocrity by head and shoulders. He's turning into a pretty good coach, despite everyone's predictions.
He took a team with basically just Luka to the conference finals 2 years ago, beat Phoenix in game 7. Nobody saw that coming. And then 2 years later, on the verge of taking this team to the NBA finals. And as a 5 seed, you just don't see that very often.
He seems to also have solved the puzzle that is Kyrie Irving.
Yeah. I mean, Kyrie is, you know, knock on wood, he's been a great corporate citizen and whatever. And we'll hopefully continue to see that.
Yeah. You should for sure get rid of him in the offseason because he can't keep this up 2 years in a row. All right. Anything else on NBA playoffs? Conference.
We'll have plenty of time. We're like 4 or 5 pods probably before the finals.
Yeah. Yeah. It's ridiculous. So, all right. Let's stick with you, Pope. NHL playoffs. I mean, this is your time to shine. The playoffs, the only time to follow.
Yeah. The seasonal Stanley Cup follower right here.
Yeah.
Dallas seized control last night in a a great comeback. I mean, Edmonton was up 2-0 quickly. It looked like it was going the wrong direction. But Robertson had a hat trick, and they were able to hold on. Rupe Hintz is back, and that makes a big difference for Dallas on their front line. So that's going to be, I think that's going seven. I think Edmonton wins game four. I think that's going seven, and it's a coin toss. I like Dallas, but not by much. I think it's a really tough series for the Stars. On the other side, the Rangers also did the same thing, took home ice back with a 2-1 overtime. They had their two overtime wins now, 5-4 in game three and 2-1 in game two. But the Panthers, you know, I don't think they were in the Stanley Cup last year finals. I don't think they're going to go away. And I think that's going 7-2. I think we'll have a lot more hockey to talk about than basketball for the next couple pods.
You know, having the Rangers.
Go ahead, Rooster.
I was going to say, having the Rangers go this far has caused viewership to go up 45% over last year's series between the Panthers and the Hurricanes at this level.
Wow.
That's
how many Rangers fans are out there.
You got to think that the league wants to see, I'm guessing they want to see the Rangers in Edmonton, right? Because all of Canada will be rooting for Edmonton, won't they?
Yeah. Well, they could have had at this stage the Rangers and the Bruins, and that would really have been a viewership bonanza.
Can I say my one piece of hockey strategy pet peeve? I stayed up last night to watch the end of that and saw Edmonton down a goal, pull their goalie with 2.5 minutes left.
Yep.
That's just too long. It's just way too far out. And of course, within like 20, 30 seconds, Dallas scored the second goal to make it like over. But I don't know. Like, you guys are hockey experts. Do we need to pull it at 2.5 minutes?
2.5 minutes?
That's
absurd minutes.
I am certain.
That's what you're seeing in the playoffs, though. I mean, Stars have done it.
I'm certain that the answer to that is there are some analytics that have established that that's the appropriate time to do it, right? Yes. I mean, you know, first of all, if it's a minute, you don't really give yourself enough time.
Think about a power play. Piece.
You know, you look at a power play as a companion to it. Power play goals, I don't know. I'd be very curious to know the data on where in a power play a goal is most often scored. I suspect it's probably somewhere between 45 seconds and a minute 30, right? That's probably on the bell curve where the most goals are scored. So I bet you it's all analytics about how long do you need to properly, you know, set up a one-man advantage, get enough shots on net, and hope something goes in. So I don't think it's just willy-nilly. I think that there's a lot of data behind it.
If you're a college kid listening and want to be an intern for the SMQBs to run some data analytics on this, we'd love to have you on board.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I'm dying to know will the Canadians root for Edmonton just because they're a Canadian team?
No.
I can't imagine.
No?
Look, Moose, we've asked Moose that question, and we're surprised at how anti-Canadian the guy seems to be.
Yeah, like in I'm sure he has nothing for Dallas ever, but Dallas versus Edmonton, is he really going to root for Dallas because he hates Edmonton? I mean, maybe.
Maybe.
Well, I can't imagine anybody rooting for Dallas other than people who live in Dallas for any sport. At any time.
unless they have monetary interest in it, right?
Right, exactly. Right. Yes, I do. I am rooting for one more win for the Mavericks, by the way. All right, anything else on the playoffs, NHL? Well, Pope, I'll just say that there's at least four people in the world right now that are really rooting for anything but the Mavs and the Stars to be in the finals playing for championships at one time. So letting you know.
Let me just say this among us chickens. I have been very soft, about this whole thing. Imagine if this was House and this was the Flyers and the Sixers.
Insufferable. Oh my God. It's so true.
Yeah.
It's
well, so also I also root for those teams year yeah. long, so I have a
wow.
There's a pool there back. Hey, you went there.
Wow.
Got over
really?
The bat.
Gonna go there.
Okay.
You didn't wow. you didn't have much rooting for the Flyers this year, then, did you?
There's nothing to root for.
It's, right. Wouldn't it be perfect though if all of this happened and then the Cowboys like don't even make the playoffs?
Yes.
Or first round knockout.
Yeah, Pope, would you be okay with both these championships and the Cowboys going 3-14 for the next 5 years?
Yeah.
Wow.
No.
Wow.
No. No. No way.
That is one of the most shocking like answers years. I've ever heard.
No way.
That's interesting. I think neither I would gonna take happen. Two championships.
Yeah.
That's a good question.
If
all right,
they,
let's
if,
move on.
I'm not going to get ahead we of
it. Yeah, we got to move on. Don't jinx yourself, Pope. Don't, all right, House, we've been joking, having a little fun, but we do want to take on something a little more serious and tragic, and that's the passing of PGA player Grayson Murray. Tell us a little bit about that story, House.
Well, I know Milk was probably going to jump on this too, because I actually confess I did not know very much about his career. I remembered hearing this guy from out of nowhere win a tournament earlier this year. And I honestly just thought that was because, and maybe it was because the PGA was kind of being watered down by a split between the PGA and LIV, that all of a sudden somebody like Grayson Murray is winning a championship. I had not remembered. And as soon as the very tragic news came out, you know, Milk sent around a note on our text string that, you know, wasn't he battling with some dependency problems? And so Milk, you might have followed his career, at least not like for years and years, but his story a little bit more than I had.
Yeah, no, I mean, I a little bit. I mean, I know obviously he gained some fame earlier this year when he won the Sony Open. And then that got him into the Masters, I think. But I mean, he's top 50 player.
Number 58.
But a big junior level golfer, like tons of potential, then ran into a lot of alcoholism. He was drinking during tournaments, real significant battle with mental illness. I think it just came out that it was a carbon monoxide poisoning in his garage or something.
Oh shit.
Like
I hadn't seen that.
Yeah. He went home from the tournament and killed himself.
Yeah.
We knew that.
At like, you know, 12 in the morning or something. So who knows what happened, but, yeah, just a real tragic story because it's from what I can understand, like real favorite amongst the players, nice guy. He had turned his life around in January. He was even making comments like, I've been through such a dark period and now I'm back. And I mean, I think it was really unexpected, but it goes to show you how bad mental illness is and people are fighting things that they're not public with. And it's a real sad story.
Did any of you guys see the interview that at the Colonial that they did with his playing partner on Friday?
Mal Mattis. Yeah.
He broke down. He couldn't even finish.
But the story there that I want to know more about is apparently he was, I don't know what happened on the course, but I don't know if I'm pronouncing this right. Mal Mattis, you know, the guy who you're talking about, who was his playing partner.
Yeah. Peter Menotti or whatever.
Yeah. Said, two PGA officials, somebody should watch this guy. Like there, he was expressing something on the course that worried him enough where he, because I think, I'm not sure whether he withdrew before the round was complete, like after 16 holes or something, or
yeah, he
did the round and then just withdrew. But he, apparently he said something to the PGA officials. So, Jesus. I don't know. Just very, very sad.
Well, that's hard to hear too. I mean, there's so much tragedy around the story, but, you know, unfortunately, whenever there is a tragedy like this, there's always people who think, should I have done more? Should I have been there? And, you know, the answer, of course, is you can never expect something, you know, like this. And, you know, nobody should blame themselves. On the other hand, you know, it does say that, you know, people need to look out for each other, right? I mean, don't be afraid to you know, to put your arms around someone, to go to their friends and family and tell them you're worried, to ask questions, because you really do never know what someone's dealing with. And a lot of times, if you get a whiff of it, you know, your gut instinct is right a lot of times, right? I mean, so that's really tragic to hear. I feel for that, for his playing partner, because that's something that'll stick with him for a long time, I bet.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, do we want to say anything more on that?
I just...
There's just nothing good to cover on that. It's just, horrific.
Like you said, I hope eventually these stories, there have been so many, I feel like on the pod, we talked through at least five or six of them about players speaking out about depression, stepping away from the sport about depression. Now someone took their life while in the midst of their playing career. I really hope, whether it's these leagues doing something about mental health or doing public service announcements, you know, there's just so much competition and pressure. I really hope that out of the tragedy, there's some kind of spotlight that can be put on dealing with depression and managing through that depression with dependency and all the other things. It's very sad. These people are real people too.
Yeah.
For sure. I don't
have an answer for that. All right. Rooster, we have another sad story to report.
Yeah.
Talk about the passing of a real legend.
Bill Russell. You know,
Bill Walton.
Bill Walton. I'm sorry, Bill Walton. Bill Walton.
One of the
died at age 71 yesterday. And what I wanted to talk about was something a little different than what most people remember him for, but because of maybe my age. You know, I remember him before he was the zany analyst and Pac-12 guru, and before he was the lumbering sixth man on the 1986 Celtics championship team. None other than Larry Bird, who really doesn't compliment many people, said that when healthy, Bill Walton was as good as anyone who's ever played in the NBA. And people don't remember that. And what he was referring to is that Bill Walton's had 39 surgeries during his playing career, and mostly on his feet and ankles, which is pretty rough for big guys like him, 6'11". I mean, we all know of big guys who've had foot problems, and like Yao Ming, who are out almost instantly once it pops up. Bill Walton was so good that at UCLA in three seasons from 72 to 74, he won three consecutive Player of the Year awards. During that stretch, they won 88 consecutive games without a loss. In the 73 championship game, he scored 44 points and missed one shot. He took 22 shots and missed one. He actually made 23 of 25, but they had outlawed dunking during that period. And a couple of putbacks were ruled dunks, so they disqualified the shots. Or he would have had 48 points, 13 rebounds, 7 blocks. He was just a really amazing player. And what Larry Bird was referring to is Jokic. Everyone thinks Jokic is like one of the greatest of all time. Bill Walton was Jokic and a better athlete. Bill Walton was the same way as Jokic. He would get a rebound and dribble the ball down the court and make incredible passes. But he was also better on his feet, more nimble, faster. You know, he had all the moves Jokic has and all the decision-making prowess, but he was a better athlete. He was the number one pick in 1974 by the Blazers, and within three seasons had them got them their only national championship, their only NBA championship. And the team has never won another one. So pretty hapless franchise. This rookie comes along. and just wows the entire league and beats the Sixers in the 1977 finals and is named the finals MVP. That's how good he was. And he would have continued to be that good, but for all these injuries. And this, just to show you a little bit about his character, fast forward 9 years from that finals title, and he's in his second finals as the sixth man off the bench for the Celtics. Not too many mega superstars would be comfortable in that role, but he was. And I think he considered that to be his greatest sports accomplishment because he played through all kinds of basically disabilities and contributed as the sixth man of the year that year to the conference, to the NBA finals win by the Celtics, giving him two rings. He was just an amazing athlete. And I think he's known a little too much as this goofy Grateful Dead follower who said weird things during interviews, but he was a terrific, could have been one of the best centers in the history of the game if he hadn't gotten injured.
Yeah, he was larger than life. He's one of those guys, you know, walks into the room and takes over immediately. Everybody wanted to be friends with Bill, and he had a big heart. I mean, obviously the description you made of him, he was a deadhead, kind of like the, you know, the main deadhead, if you identify them, and was friends with the band. I can't tell you, I didn't listen to him all the time, but he would be on like the Maui Basketball Invitational telecast for ESPN. And my wife and I would listen to him, and he would just, a stream of consciousness, just, it shows you how brilliant he is as far as his ability to, you know, just try to relate everything in life to basketball and just ramble. And they were always enjoyable. So, I mean, in addition to being a great broadcaster, I mean, he was just a great human.
He was on a major. Yeah, he had cancer. He was fighting cancer.
I didn't realize that.
I read it was prostate, and he'd been battling it for quite a while. And I don't think it was public.
But yeah, I had no idea.
Because of his back injury, that on top of all these foot and ankle injuries, he pretty much gave up being a national broadcaster. He was on the team with Mike Breen and Snapper Jones for a while, and that was a pretty formidable broadcast team. But he got to the point where he didn't want to travel off the West Coast to do games.
Well, we'll definitely pour one out for Bill Walton. Definitely a big loss for basketball and just for anybody who was curious about life. All right, let's throw a punch. Don't call it a comeback. Rooster, you got a punchable face?
I do. I'm going to punch the very punchable Max Verstappen's father, Jost Verstappen.
Jost.
I'm going to fight somebody my own age for once. look, no athlete likes their parent getting involved and creating friction with their teammates. It's just embarrassing. And that's exactly what Jost did after the French Grand Prix. You know, he's going, giving interviews saying that Red Bull's a mess. The period of their dominance is over. Their problems with their car, they've been hiding for 2 years. And here was his quote: Max has been good at hiding some of the problems, but we can see how big the difference is between him and his teammate.
Oh,
what? Who needs that? If even Max Verstappen must have thought, I don't need Checo hearing that bullshit.
Right.
It's just wrong. It's stupid. It's just a parent who can't get out of his own way. Milk and I know somebody like that. anyway, just get your own life, Jost. Just shut up. And
he is a class A asshole.
He truly is. And he's creating all these problems with Red Bull that his son doesn't need. And it's just wrong. He needs to be schmackened.
second. All right, good one.
Needs to be punched in the steering wheel.
All right, let's get a lasso.
Barbecue sauce.
House?
I have two brief lassos. I didn't know when I said in the buzzer beaters a week or two ago, like, everybody give attention to the college baseball playoffs that are upcoming. It'll be a lot of fun to watch, that it would produce such, like, amazing stories. You probably have all seen by now, I don't think anybody would ever follow very much unless you were maybe like a catcher for a division, whatever, baseball. Well, you guys were Division I Georgetown, right?
Yep. Yeah, definitely.
Okay. Okay. So we're not, when we talk about Division III baseball, that is something that we're not really familiar with, most of us. But this story of Birmingham Southern, have you guys seen the story?
Yes. This is good.
Yeah.
Okay. This is nuts. This school has been around for 168 years. And of all years that they're just decided to throw the towel in and close down the doors of the school, it is this year. And the school is closing the doors. And I mean, it's over, kaput. It's the end of the school on Friday, May 31st. And you know what's happening on Friday, May 31st? The Birmingham Southern team without a school is going to be playing in the Division III College World Series.
That's awesome.
They competed. They made it into the regional, and then they made it through to the super regional, and then like half their team got sick with food poisoning. And so they've got the backups playing in the super regional championship, and yet they win the game and now are in the Division III College World Series without a school, which has led to all kinds of jokes, like, you know, like, where does the trophy go if they win it? You know,
like, that's great.
I mean, are they pay your own way for the transportation?
I'm going to say, so, funding. I mean, do they have like bus transportation? I mean,
I don't know. I mean, maybe someone needs to start a Kickstarter for them. But this is crazy. Birmingham Southern is a true, either lasso or comedy. I don't know, but it's a good story. And this other one, the guy behind me, Jackson Lynn. The reason this is a lasso is, I just love these stories of,
because he plays at Tulane.
Well, that's a good start.
Right.
I mean, he's got a really big head start. But I think you guys would acknowledge that somebody who has been waiting for 3 years to play baseball, because not only did he have one Tommy John surgery, he comes back from the Tommy John surgery and it just didn't take. So he has another Tommy John surgery. How many baseball players at any level decide to keep playing the sport after that? So he comes back, and after basically being on the sideline for 3 years, starts playing this season, and he's just not playing very well January through April. And the question is, like, do we even keep this guy in the lineup? He's holding up a spot. But he catches fire in May. And sure enough, you know, they make a run through. They don't even lose a game in the American Athletic Conference Championship. And this guy hits not one, but two home runs, a home run to tie the game at 7, and then a second home run to win the game in the bottom of the ninth with two outs. And I don't know if that's not a lasso, a guy who comes back from two Tommy John surgeries to hit a walk-off home run to propel your team to the college, you know, NCAA championship tournament in baseball. That's a pretty good story. Even you guys have to give it to the Wave there.
Oh, we're talking about we're off the Birmingham team now.
Yeah. You need to stop smoking some of that Bill Walton ganja.
That's a good story. All right. Anybody else have a lasso? Let's do some buzzer beaters and get out of here. House, what's your buzzer beater this week?
I don't have any other buzzer beaters than I'm going to sit on my hands and allow Pope to bask in the glory of this next week or two. I'm behaving myself.
Wow.
Pope, let's hear yours.
That's a buzzer beater right there. I don't have one.
Yeah.
Mine is, I'm just happy for Nace that Angel Hernandez is done.
No. Oh.
I know he's really happy about
all
it,
of us. So.
That was gonna be mine. There is
mine too. Mine too.
Yeah.
What an awkward retirement announcement. Not one former player, league executive, coach, no one came out and said a kind word when he announced his retirement. Instead, here's the CBS Sports headline. Angel Hernandez retires. 8 of the controversial umpire's worst calls, including disastrous 2018 ALDS. It's all anyone can talk about. So long, Angel. Don't let the door hit you in the way out.
It is literally like one of the most celebrated in MLB recent history.
Just to be that hated in your profession, my God.
But he was that bad. He was that bad.
Ugh.
And in other umpires acting badly news, this submission from Cousin Justin, one of our loyal listeners here. If you have not seen the video of the umpire throwing out anybody on the Marlins team from the May 14th game, where he just heard something that upset him and he throws out somebody and they don't know who, you got to go check out. It's John Boy, JOMBOY is where you can find it. These guys do these like lip syncs of what's actually being said on a game. They're really funny in general, but this one is outrageous. You've got to look it up. It's the umpire, like literally the crew chief comes in and is like, I don't know, you're going to have to throw somebody out of the game though, because he threw someone out. So you got to toss somebody. It is too much. I mean, umpires, man, they are a special breed. And I really, for these reasons, I hope we never go to robot umpires, because these moments are just too special to lose. Any other buzzer beaters?
I'm just going to speak up though for umpires. It's a tough job. It really is a tough job. When I was a kid, I umpired, you know, in Little League games once I got a little older. And I think I was umping second base. And it was like my first, it was like a playoff game. It's my first season umpiring. I was the youngest umpire out there. And the crew chief decided to mess with me. So this team hits a home run. And the other team throws the ball to second base, challenging whether the guy touched the bag.
Oh no.
And the home plate umpire comes out and says,
Did you
see it? I said, I didn't see it. I don't have no idea. And he said, well, I saw it. I clearly saw it. He didn't touch the bag. Call him out. So I call the guy out and the whole place erupts. And one of my best friend's dads was the coach of the other team. And he comes running out to me and before I could say anything, the home plate ump said, I didn't see it, but he said he saw it. I just screwed me. That was really.
Holy crap.
Clearly, Rooster hasn't gotten over it.
I still have nightmares about that call.
Rooster, umpire, sympathizer. Who knew?
Was Babe Ruth pitching?
Wow.
All right, guys, good show this week. Thanks, everybody. Go, let's start that.
The SMQBs are Brian Bandwagon Pope, who hails from Dallas, Texas, and has never met a first-place team that he didn't have a personal connection to. Michael Rooster Phelan, hailing from Richmond, and who roots for teams from New York, or is it Boston? I can't remember which it was. One or the other. Also, Patrick Milk Michler from Tampa Bay, and he is still massively in love with Tom Brady and will never get over his man crush on the GOAT. Toby House Milrod, a long-suffering sports fan hailing from Philadelphia, whose Eagles team, they're still looking for another quarterback. And I am Chris Bison Nace, hailing from Washington, District of Champions. Thanks for listening.